My name's Chris Raymer, very grateful recovered alcoholic.
Can y'all hear me okay?
My head's still full from the stupid flight. I don't know why, I can't hear. So it sounds like I'm screaming, but if I get a little quiet, start pointing at your ear and I'll speak up. So how many of y'all were there last night? If you just raise your hand real quick. We got some newbies in. You may be a little... I think if you were there last night, you kind of know where I'm coming from. What I want to do this morning, we're going to swap the podium back and forth. I got about 45 minutes, and I want to talk to you about this idea of qualifying an alcoholic. Because my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous was that I had such a difficult time getting sober. And I started going to AA in the States, in Texas, in the early 80s. And I didn't get sober, finally, until 1987. So I had a 7-year history of doing what I watch so many people do, and that's go in and out and in and out and in and out, this chronic relapse stuff. And unfortunately, what I get to see is a lot of people never make it back in the doors. After a period of time, you just lose hope. And one of the problems is that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1980, no one qualified me. I got to say this before I get into it again, because I don't want anybody to get cranky today. You are absolutely free to agree or disagree with anything I say. We're coming out of the big book, and I'm sharing my experience. I do clerical work for a treatment center and down in Texas, and we treat thousands. Well, we treat about 1,000 alcoholics and addicts a year at this hospital. And so, I mean, I've been there 13 years, so you do the math. You know, I mean, I've watched a bunch of cats come through. And I also sponsor a bunch of men. That's my program. And it's by working with others that we get to stay sober ourselves. So I'm just trying to share some experience, my experience with you. If it doesn't jive with your experience, that's perfectly okay. I didn't come all the way to Switzerland to tell you how to do it. These are just some observations that we've gathered along the way from studying the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm sure Peter can allude to that too when he gets a chance to visit with you. Just because you drink a lot doesn't make you an alcoholic. That's so controversial sometimes, you know, because there's a lot of people that drink too much. But given sufficient reason, those folks will stop or moderate eventually. The alcoholism and drug addiction is a disease, and it's progressive in nature. We understand, we talked about a bit last night, this is a genetic predisposition. You either have it, or you don't. It's like being allergic to a food. If you're allergic to, who knows, whatever, you stay away from it. You know, how do you find out? You try it. It makes you sick, you quit. Peter's obviously allergic to Italian food. He needs to learn to stay away from this stuff, you know? But let me explain kind of what happened in the States, because the ripple effect starting in Akron, you know, kind of rippled out. And I mean, it eventually got to Europe, and we're all a product of that in this country. In 1935, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob got together and started Alcoholics Anonymous. Y'all are all familiar with that story. It's in the big book. You don't have to be a historian to know that little story. In the first 35 years, we had approximately 500,000 sober alcoholics in the United States and surrounding countries where people would travel to. It took us 35 years to get 500,000 members in this fellowship. About 1971, Nixon, President Nixon, some of y'all remember him? Right up there with Bush. Okay. Right before Nixon was on his way out the door, he signed into legislation a little thing called the Hughes Act, which, in a very general term, it acknowledged alcoholism as a disease. And what happened as a result of that is that insurance companies got on the bandwagon and started paying like slot machines in the United States for people that wanted to come to treatment. The worst insurance policies out there carried riders on there to treat alcoholism and drug addiction, because they were going to make $1 million on this. Now the government's acknowledging that this is a disease, and we're going to get rich. It was a little bit of a mistake on their part. Because what happened is that every Tom, Dick, and Harry, any idiot with a big book, came down the pike and decided that they could open a treatment center. And we had thousands of centers opening in the United States. And some of these were very good. Some of these are still in existence today. And some of these were absolutely horrible. You'll follow? And a lot of people came into these hospitals and didn't get well. Left. Relapsed. And the insurance companies got sick and tired of paying for something that wasn't working, so they stopped paying. That's what we're experiencing now in the United States. If you really want to get sober, you better have a pocket full of money in our country. And I happen to work at a hospital that takes lots of pocketfuls of money. And I'm glad I worked there. But the long and short of it, what happened was we saw lots and lots of people come into the fellowship via these treatment centers. Now, the hospitals weren't teaching the 12 steps. They weren't teaching the traditions. They weren't teaching Jack. What they were doing was giving a bunch of little one-liners because the insurance companies wouldn't pay for the big book. Y'all down with that? What the insurance companies would pay for is what we were talking about last night, your triggers lists and Gorski stuff and relapse prevention. And they treated Alcoholics Anonymous like it was a self-help program. And we immediately got away from the roots of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was a spiritual program of action. Your higher power, your business, but it's spiritual in nature. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a self-help program. It is not therapy. The steps get me connected to a spiritual experience, and that spiritual experience removes the obsession to drink. That's the way it works. You with us? The problem is the steps are a little uncomfortable to do at times. Most of us are great. Most of us we're great at like 1, 2, 3. You know, we call it the 3-step shuffle in Texas. You know, it's a little dance. You know, it's like a country western dance. You know, 1, 2, 3, drink. 1, 2, 3, drink. You know, and that's what we do. Because it's easy. Because all you got to do is you got to sit on your butt and just sit there. And you know, and in treatment, of course, they qualify the alcoholic. They ask you a bunch of stupid questions. How many DWIs have you had? Driving while intoxicated. You with us? How many times have you been arrested? How many times have you wet your pants? You know, and it's like, excuse me? But you see, my book, the big book that I read, doesn't say anything about a DWI. Or, I mean, that's why we were talking about last night. When I went to Alcoholics Anonymous in the early 80s, I sat in these rooms and listened to all these horrible war stories, and I says, I'm trying to identify. That's why they're giving us the war stories. But I can't identify. Because I'm a functioning alcoholic. I'm in corporate America. I'm a professional chef. And I can't identify. I don't have any DWIs. I don't black out. You sit in these meetings long enough, you'll hear. I mean, you know, it's you start over here and it's, I've had one DWI. And you start over here and it's, I've had three DWIs. And, that's nothing. You think that's bad. I've had six DWIs and I beat my wife and I robbed a liquor store. And I'm sitting, you know, I'm smiling. Thanks for sharing. You know, but I'm in mental check. I have never done that. You know, I'll get out in the truck, open a quart of beer, go. I said, boy, that was a nice meeting, but I must not be an alcoholic because I've never chopped up people and put them in a plastic bag and threw them. I don't understand why we do it. Still to this day, I argue about telling war stories in meetings. War stories, our stories, it talks about on page 17, are there for a 12-step call. Our common problem is one element of cement that binds us. You with us? We all know what it's like to hurt. But, guys, if that's all we have to share, shame on us. What we have is a common solution. The same steps that got me sober in 1987 will get that little cat that was screaming out of my window at 5 o'clock this morning, drunk on his butt. It'll help him too. But we come from two different worlds. So what? The disease is the same. Y'all down with that? The problem is that we don't have anybody out there in AA land, in the countries, most of the areas, they won't qualify us. We've got too many people hanging around Alcoholics Anonymous that don't need to hang around Alcoholics Anonymous. You need a good therapy, eat some meds, go away. I talked about it last night, guys. The book is crystal clear. If you can stay sober on a non-spiritual basis, you're not one of us. Over and over in the first 164 pages, Bill Wilson makes this point very clear. I'm going to show you what the book asks us to ask the newcomer. And I'm in AA for 7 years, and nobody ever asked me this stuff right here. All they did was try to identify with a stupid war story. And I'm going to tell you, they scared me out of the rooms. And I still watch that today. Little businesswoman, nice lady like Julia comes in, you know, and she's coming into a noon meeting, and she's kind of freaked out. She doesn't know anything what's going on. Is this a cult? Are they going to, you know, sacrifice virgins in here? What are we going to do? You know, and she's a little nervous, but everybody keeps saying, well, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so she's sitting in there, and she can sense that there's an answer here. And we say, oh, we have a newcomer. And the first thing we do is we start telling all the stupid war stories. She's a professional businesswoman. She's not out there smoking crack cocaine and hooking on I don't know anything about it. I don't know. But you see her, she tenses up and she gets a little purse and puts it in her lap, you know, so like that. It gets up, thanks everybody, and leaves, and we never see her again. And then we want to look back at her and say, well, she just didn't want it. Did we give her the message that she so desperately needed? You follow us? Just because you drink a lot doesn't make you an alcoholic. The disease has three symptoms. These are the symptoms. I'm gonna show you as a result of not qualifying. In 1955, you read the foreword of the second edition, we had a success rate in this country of 75% in the United States. Excuse me. Where am I? 75% success rate in the United States. There were areas around Cincinnati, the Midwest, where we had an almost 100% success rate of cats coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and staying sober. Right now in the United States, our success rate hovers around 8% or less. Now, how do we take a perfectly good program that worked unbelievably well but a few years ago, and now practically nobody can get sober? Everybody wants to make excuses. Oh, it's them crack addicts. Oh, it's them kids. Oh, it's the Baptists. Oh, it's the Catholics. Oh, it's the breakdown of the family unit. Oh, I just want to puke. No, it's that we stopped using the big book. You can go into most meetings where I got sober in 1980, from 80 to 87. You'd walk into meetings and there wouldn't be a big book in the place. You read how it works, and then first thing out of everybody's mouth is, well, who's got the problem? And we would spend an hour talking about your problem. Oh, and by the way, that problem wasn't alcoholism. You know, it was the kids, or it was my sister-in-law did this, or the work did this, or the traffic, or the weather, or my hemorrhoids, or I don't know. Drives me nuts. We got to stop that. We got to take our fellowship back and start talking about what we need to talk about in these meetings. And that's how to get connected to God. That's what our traditions ask us to do. Our fifth tradition says we're supposed to carry the message to the newcomer. What's the message? The 12 steps. I'll say this real quick. No, I won't. Yeah, I will. I don't know about you guys here, but we try to really adhere to the traditions in the area where I'm sober at in the United States. They're in Texas. And we try to keep this singleness of purpose pretty clear. You know, little crack addict comes into our AA meeting and starts talking about smoking crack, or little heroin addict comes in there and starts talking about the spike, you know, and you know, some old geezer will get up and, you know, shh, buddy, this is an AA meeting. We're here to talk about our problems with alcohol. They're doing exactly what they're supposed to do to keep this message clear for the alcoholic. Nobody has a problem with that. But yet you can come into the same meeting tomorrow and talk about your stupid divorce one more time. And how in the hell is that different than talking about crack cocaine in an AA meeting? It's not. Come before the meeting. Let's talk about the divorce. Stay after the meeting. Let's go to dinner. Come over to my house. But for an hour a day, why can't we just talk about the message out of the big book? We would see success rates go straight back through the ceiling. That's my soapbox. I'm off of it. And I feel better, too, having said that. This is what the big book says. We've got approximately 10 to 15% of us in the United States, and I honestly don't know what the stats are here in Europe, but pretty close to that. So 10 to 15% of us are genetically wired alcoholic addicts. We're born that way. There's some great books, I can give you the titles of later if you're interested, about the genetic predisposition to alcoholism and drug addiction. Alcoholism and drug addiction is not causal. You're born that way. Most of us, if you get in there and you're talking to some real alcoholics and you start talking about what we're talking about here, they can identify these symptoms when they were 8 years old. You don't have to wait till you're blacked out someplace. I mean, we're born this way. A small percentage of us are alcoholic and addict. The rest of the percentage that we call hard drinkers or moderate drinkers, they can take it or leave it alone. Here's this, it's a three-part disease. Y'all see it on the circle and triangle. That was what was the original circle triangle was all about. It signified the physical, the mental, and the spiritual. Thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous is bad clerical work. We lost the copyright to that, so they took it out of the fourth edition. And so it's not, we stamp it in our book so that we can get back to the root. But I'll never forgive them for that. You think they care? I'm gonna. Physical peace is about the word called control, about the phenomena called craving. The doctor's opinion, up to page 23 in the big book, talks about the physical craving. And you either got this or you don't. And a newcomer can identify with this. What I was saying, in order to work the 12 steps, I've got to have something behind me pushing me through those steps. Because when it starts to get difficult on that fourth step, like we were talking about earlier, it's easy to sit and do the first three steps. But now I got to actually start doing something, go make amends? If you're not convinced that you're one of us, you're gonna crap out. You're gonna stop. And that's what we see so many people do. And then they stop, and then they get sick again. If you keep going, you'll get well. You with us? This physical piece looks like this. At certain times, not every time the book says, but at certain times, I can't control how much I drink once I start. Did you ever set out to drink, have a couple of glasses of wine with dinner and end up drinking a bottle? Or two? Okay. I give everybody a bonus loss of control. You know, because when we're kids and we don't know what the stuff does to us, we everybody eventually pukes straight up. I mean, that's what we do. But after that, can you learn from that and stop? I've used this example 1,000 times in my own family. You know, my little sister, and I said, Lisa, you want another drink? And she's a year younger than me, and she says, no, thank you. I'm starting to feel it. You with it? It's like, y'all, me too. Do you want another drink or not? Because it doesn't make any sense. Excuse me. I'm assuming that her experience with the alcohol is the same as my experience. But what's happening is she starts to drink and starts to feel a little goofy, and then she wants to quit. I start to drink and start feeling... Y'all should have seen the whole audience exhale. That's pretty good. But you see, we understand that, and normal people don't understand that. About the time she's losing control, I'm gaining a semblance of control. But what's happened is this phenomenon of craving kicks in, and I end up drinking too much. And it gets away from me, and I make a fool of myself, and I come back home, and I got a big old hangover, and I wake up the next morning, and I say, I'm never going to do that again. You with us? And of course, the big book calls it the insane experiment of the first drink. And then I start drinking it again, and it gets away from me again. You know, I mean, how many times do we have to do this to realize that there's something a little goofy about what we do? This, watch my time here. This physical piece, again, the big book spins from the doctor's opinion up to page 23, generally talking about what happens when I ingest the substance. Now, if that's all we had to deal with, what we would have was a behavioral problem. You follow us? It's this physical part that's a problem. This is as far as it's my buddy Nancy Reagan ever took it. That's where the just say no crap came from. You follow us? Well, if you know you can't control it, dummy, just don't drink. You with us? We got a guy in the little town where I live. It's been sober about 30 plus years, and that's the best he can come up with. Every time he speaks, he says, and remember, looking right at the little newcomer, and remember, if you don't drink the first one, you won't get drunk. And I come out of my skin every time I hear this moron say it. You know, it's like, you're not telling her the whole story. I'm going to kill him when I get back to the States. That's all there is to it. When you combine this physical peace, okay, with the mental peace, now we got something to look at. All right, hang on, I got to set this down. Most controversial word in Alcoholics Anonymous today is this word right here, choice. Those treatment centers that were killing people in the United States, not understanding this, they don't understand this choice thing. I have never talked to a doctor, therapist, counselor, probation officer, significant other, Al-Anon member. I've never talked to anybody that can't get their mind around this physical piece. That's why we spend an entire time in treatment trying to keep people away from alcohol. You with us? Don't go near it. Don't be around it. How in the hell are you going to do that? Well, we'll talk about that later. Just don't do it now. You know, it's like, well, what? Wait a minute. The alcohol's not the problem. I'm the problem. And if it continues to bother me, I'm going to... Okay, y'all with us? Choice. If you got your books, some of you, if you don't, you're taking notes. The book says on page 23... The observations would be academic. Top of page 23, it says, these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend just never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. You with us? We can get you past the physical piece, folks. It's called detox. A lot of you guys are familiar with that. You know, I've detoxed often. I detox well. You know, the problem is I can't stay detoxed. Okay? The next page shows me why I can't. And this is the next page that nobody bothered to show me in 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. 7 years in AA, I don't even have a big book. Makes me want to scream. Top paragraph on page 24 of the italics. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable, at certain times, to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory and suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. You with us? That's why the book continues to say in page after page, no human power is going to be able to defend us from the drink. That's why we have to have the spiritual experience. The question that the book is asking me to ask you, does this apply to you? Can you relate? Can you choose to stop and make it stick? Talking to a lady down in the valley in Texas, and I was talking about, you know, in my story, I'd taken a bunch of antidepressants most of my adult life, and when I got sober, I was able to wean off those antidepressants and hadn't taken any since, because the problem was not that I was depressed or bipolar or manic depressive. The problem was I was an alcoholic, and when alcoholism was arrested, all of that other stuff went away. Y'all follow us? And this lady wants to take exception with what I'm saying from the podium. What she did was, she came to Alcoholics Anonymous, got hooked up with a good doctor. The doctor gave her some sleep medication. And I said, wait. Why were you drinking? Well, that's what I'm trying to tell you. I was drinking because I couldn't sleep. Uh-huh. That was the only reason you were drinking. Uh-huh. So they gave her some sleep medication. She didn't have to drink anymore. But she's been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 13 years killing people with that crap. Can you imagine what the girls she sponsors get to do? They get to go to doctors and get the sleep medication. 26.5 million prescriptions for sleep medication in the United States last year. Freaks me out. Absolutely nonsense. Rubbish. This is what you do to qualify alcoholism. Physical allergy. Can you control it every time? No, I can't do that. Mental obsession. Given sufficient reason, can you quit and stay quit? Go back. Look at your truth based on your experience. Not what you think you're going to do in the future. You with us? They come to treatment. Well, I've never been in this much trouble before. I'm going to stop. Buddy, how many times have you said that in the past? 1,000 times. Can you choose to stop and make it stick? What does your experience show you?
Because I get caught in what the book calls my mental blank spot. He says the consequences of even a week or a month ago, we don't remember. That's why it drives me crazy when we sit in meetings and tell these stupid war stories. You're not even going to remember your own stupid war story, much less mine. I don't know. Isn't it the truth? This right here. Third piece, again, is something that even in the States, people don't want to talk about. But the big book talks about it on dozens of pages. The spiritual malady. The third piece of the disease. The spiritual illness. Folks, this has got very little to do, if anything, with believing in God. Everybody wants to grind their teeth over this. This is about not believing in God, but gaining access to that power. It's two different things. The spiritual malady looks like this. I drew this little guy up here. He's issue man. I've got these little buttons up here. Y'all are welcome to. I got issue woman pins too. Some of y'all definitely need those pins. Issues are what we drink over. You know, you tell the therapist, Chris, why are you drunk again? And I'm telling the therapist, I got all these little X's on the outside that indicate. Patty, my wife, she brought it to my attention that the little issue woman pin has one more X on it than the men. She said, yeah, that's you. But this little internal condition, this little dark spot that I've drawn here, that's the spiritual malady. It looks like this. Let me give you the symptoms. How many of y'all understand? Let me clarify. Away from the drink, this is vino. And I haven't had any. The further away I get from that drink, now I answer the question. Everybody wants to talk about what happens after I drink. You know, I eat out of dumpsters, I do this, I do that. But when I'm not drinking, do you understand the symptom of irritable? Restless. Discontent. Y'all ever heard that term, discontented spirit? Book talks about boredom. Anxiety. How about depression? Number one symptom of alcoholism and drug addiction is depression. No sense of direction. How many of y'all have done that? No sense of direction. Think about it. I call my mom, I'm fixing to go back to school. And then I'd call her after lunch. No, I've decided to start my own business instead. You know, I mean, I'm a great starter. I'm just a crappy finisher. You know, I mean, some of y'all can relate. How about trouble in personal relationships? These are on page 52, the benevolent. How about trouble in personal relationships? How about the one with yourself? This feeling of uselessness that the book talks about. This low self-esteem. We spend all of our time in treatment getting these patients to stand in front of mirrors and do these positive affirmations like that's going to work. I'm a beautiful child of God, and everyone loves me. You know, and I go back over to the bureau and load my gun, you know, as I'm fixing to off myself. You know, it's just like it doesn't work. It's nuts. You know what will help your self-esteem more than anything else? Go sit with a new drunk. Go help somebody. You'll feel better than you've ever felt in your life. But that's beside the point. It's this internal condition. The reason that I drink, folks, is the most controversial stuff we talk about. Alcohol's not my problem. The dope wasn't my problem. It was my solution. This is the problem. Guys, I've quit 1,000 times. I had a 20-year drinking history, and I knew intuitively by the time I was 19 years old that I was in way over my head and that this was going to be a bloodbath. And I knew I needed to quit. And I would stop often. And I would, my MO is about 2 weeks. And 2 weeks, the further away I would get from that drink, the less comfort I felt inside. And I would gradually become so agitated and irritable, I would get to the spot where I would say, with the pain of staying sober would outweigh the benefits. And my mind would eventually say, to heck with it. I'm going to have one. Or my deal was usually was, I'm going to smoke a joint. Oh, geez. I'm not addicted to pot. A lot of people are not addicted to pot. But if you smoke pot, this physical allergy will be kicked in too. The areas of the brain. It's called cross-addiction. We watched thousands of people leave our hospital and believe that crap. I ain't going to smoke any more crack cocaine, but I'm still going to drink alcohol. Well, what? We're just changing seats on the Titanic, guys. We're all going down. It's absolutely nuts. This spiritual malady is what the book says must be treated. On page 64 it says, once the spiritual malady is treated, the physical and the mental get straightened out. What happens when you have the spiritual experience is, the 10th step promises tell us quite clearly, is that you're going to be placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. It won't even bother you. And I sit here and I listen to people constantly talk about, can't be around here, I can't go there, I can't do this, I can't do that because there's alcohol there. What a crying shame. That's not why we got sober. If you have to walk on eggshells around alcohol and dope, if you can't be around it, you're not recovered. There's something wrong, quote unquote, out of the book, with your spiritual condition. And it's up to you whether you want to get connected or not. If you want to spend the rest of your life walking on eggshells, worrying about that elusive drink that's going to jump up and throw itself down your throat, go ahead. I don't want to do that. I just absolutely don't want to do that. Let me give you a quote real quick. I was thinking about, and I'll let Peter pick up if you've got something he'd like to share here. My friend Danny out of Maine, Danny S., says, If alcohol's your problem, then detox is as bad as it's going to get. If alcoholism is your problem, then detox is where it just begins to get bad. Make sense? A hard drinker, you can detox, and that's the worst he'll ever go through. If everybody wants to talk about these little X's, and that's what we have to do in qualifying. We have to find out, buddy, are you drinking because you can't sleep? Is that truly why you're over-drinking? Are you drinking because you're married to that evil woman? I try to explain to the guys I sponsor, buddy, get ready. They're all evil. Don't worry about it. But you see, because that's what I did for 10 years in therapy. I kept chasing the little thread to try to figure out what it was. I mean, we talked about everything under the sun, you know? It's the woman, it's the job, it's the traffic, it's being blind in one eye, you know? It was Vietnam, I'd never been to Vietnam, but we talked about it continually. I spent most of those 10 years in therapy talking about my sexual preference. We talked a lot about being gay. I'm not gay, but we talked a lot about being gay. Y'all understand? Something's bothering you. You're not being honest. You're gay, aren't you? No. But I wanted to be. You know, I mean, if I could attach a little deal to it and says, if it's that that's causing it, then I could do some good therapy around it or come out of the closet and just be openly gay, whatever, and I would stop drinking and drugging. But guys, I'm going back to apartments where I am so alone and so afraid of my own skin. I mean, I'm so uncomfortable, I can't stand it. And I'm afraid to call people and talk to people and afraid to go do life. I'm hiding out, dying. Drinking myself to death. And I will do anything to get better. And the cats that come into Alcoholics Anonymous, they're willing to do anything. They're willing to screw up their courage and come into a strange meeting with a bunch of strange people just to see what this is about. The very least we can do is grab them at the door, set them down, make them comfortable, and then as soon as we can get them detoxed just a bit so they can hear what you're saying. A couple of days, guys. We need to start qualifying them to find out if they need to be here. Do they need to be in Narcotics Anonymous instead? Is there a real problem crack cocaine? Is there a real problem heroin or whatever? We need to help them. What? Because this fellowship helps alcoholics very well. We don't do worth a poot with drug addicts. Make sense? We have a responsibility to qualify the newcomer. And if the cat doesn't want to get sober, we have a responsibility to let them go and let them go do whatever they want to go do. It's their life. We spend way too much time chasing people that don't want to get well. My passion comes from the fact that I watch lots of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who want to be sober and can't get sober because nobody will spend the time with them to show them how to get sober. You can't get sober just coming to meetings. Meetings don't treat alcoholism. If you hear nothing else I say this weekend, you've got to hear that and you've got to take it to heart. Meeting makers don't make it if you're a real alcoholic. I'm not knocking meetings. That will not get you connected to God spiritually. The 12 steps get you there. Cool? Peter, you got anything you'd like to say?
Good morning, I'm Peter, recovered alcoholic. Grateful to be alive and sober. Just a couple of things I wanted to chip in along with Chris's talk. Chris was setting up what it's like for someone to diagnose themselves as what a real alcoholic is. We suffer from allergic reaction to alcohol, that when we drink alcohol, the body craves more. The craving's intensified, not satisfied. And I have a mind, a grave emotional mental disorder, a mind that'll take me back to that which is killing me. And it's usually alcohol. And for some of us who have been around here a while, it may not be alcohol at the beginning, but my mind will take me back to something else they call sprees. Because we're feeling what Chris talked about, restless, irritable, and discontented. So I need to seek relief somewhere. So I experience sprees to go get comfort. And what I'm really doing is running away from discomfort to get some relief. And eventually, behind those sprees, because of the spiritual malady, I'll pick up a drink. And the spiritual malady. And these three things are what separate us from the moderate and the hard drinker, makes us the real alcoholic. Once the spiritual malady is overcome, we share now mentally and physically. And for the moderate or the hard drinker, or you'll hear back home, I hear a lot of people saying, well, I was a heavy hitter. That doesn't mean they're alcoholics. Even if they needed medical attention and maybe even detoxes, people who wind up in detoxes are not necessarily alcoholics. They just have to get to detox. So for the real alcoholic, and our book separates us, they use words like alcoholics of our type, allergic types in that class. What separates us, the real alcoholic probably needs the spiritual experience in order to be given a new mind and a new body. If we're not picking up a drink, we're not experiencing the allergy. All action is born of thought, so my mind takes me back to that which is killing me. Having said that, I'm clear I'm a real alcoholic, right? So I come to an AA meeting looking for a teacher, looking for a sponsor, looking for the elders to teach me, and here's where we get into trouble. If I'm clear I'm a real alcoholic, and if I study the first 43 pages of my big book, and I'm not sure, it'll make me clear. Maybe I'm just a hard drinker who needs to go to therapy and not come into Alcoholics Anonymous. But it qualifies me, I go through and I say I'm a real alcoholic. Where we get into trouble in AA is this way. Do I know if my sponsor's a real alcoholic? Because we're depending on the people in the room to give me clear instructions, guidance, direction on how to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, right? But I may sit down with Joe, who's in AA for 30 years and tells you at every minute how long he's sober, right? You know, you got those people in AA, they keep reminding you of how long they're sober because they want a monument outside the AA meeting made for them, right? But I go to Joe or Frank or Bill and seek guidance, but they may be hard drinkers or moderate drinkers who still have the power of choice. And by the way, the words power, choice, and control are interchangeable. They can still put the plug in the jug. They can still make a meeting a day and rely on the meetings as their remedy for alcoholism rather than God. Right? So I go sit down with Joe and I say, this is my fifth treatment center. I can't stop drinking. I have no power. I want to stop. I have a powerful desire to stop. I keep picking up a drink, and once I drink, I can't stop. What do I do? And Joe kicks back, folds his arms, and says, well, kid, make 90 meetings in 90 days, and don't pick up the first drink. Keep the plug in the jug. And then the newcomer gets drunk. And then Joe folds his arms and says, he didn't want it. Who's next? So, the people, us, right here, Are we clear, and we're going to talk about this in the following topics, are we clear on what we are, and do we stand at the door, men and women, armed with the real answer for the alcoholic? Because that's why a lot of us are dying. When we could talk till the cows come home about the non-AAs walking into AA, and we don't throw anyone out, they have a seat and they become part of this glorious fellowship. But it's the elder statesmen who were sitting here who aren't alcoholics either, and giving away a middle-of-the-road solution. So we have a huge responsibility, because we may get the real alcoholic man or woman walking through the door, and I'm a put-the-plug-in-the-jug guy, and that's how a lot of us are dying. What message are we carrying? Because if I'm around here a little while, and I'm just looking for a good cup of coffee and to get a date, then go elsewhere. If I'm a real alcoholic, eventually I'm going to seek out a spiritual solution to what ails me. It's called alcoholism, because the real alcoholics will eventually pick up a drink and die. And the non-alcoholics, I was given a great story. A friend of mine in Manhattan, he belonged to this group, and they did a lot of fellowshipping. And there were a handful of big book guys and a handful of people who just made 90 meetings in 90 days and did a lot of coffee and, you know, put the plug in the jug guys. And they played on this sober softball team, right? And a couple of years went by, and a lot of those big book guys got drunk. And the guys who were just not drinking, go to meetings, were still sober. And I didn't understand the point of the story. The don't drink and go to meetings guys were the hard drinkers and the moderate drinkers, and they can just hang around AA, play sober softball, and they were not picking up a drink. They made a choice every day not to drink because they weren't real alcoholics. The guys who are in the big book were the real alcoholics, and they walk away from the solution, the spiritual solution. And for people like that, there's only one thing left to do, and that's to use. And I got it. So those of us who are in here, besides qualifying the new person walking in the door, the newcomer should be qualifying who their sponsor is. Because if you're a real alcoholic, and I can tell you this experientially, if you're a real alcoholic and your sponsor is not, run for the hills. Because they'll kill you with bad information. Sorry about that. Questions? Okay, we're done. Any questions? Yes.
If you read in the chapter Working with Others, it talks about giving them a copy of this book and letting them read certain pages. It allows them to kind of see where we're going with this. But ultimately, the book asks us to ask the newcomer some specific questions. You could even, it's 164 pages. The steps are outlined in 100 pages or so. That's still, for a newcomer, a lot to read. And the sooner that we get the little guy qualified, it's just these three questions to find out. You with us? They want to come in and all they want to do is talk about the drama, all the issues. And that we have to separate that for a few minutes and just find out, are they one of us? Can we help you? Because it may be that the problem is some of this external stuff, and then I think we've got a responsibility in our fellowship to send them someplace where they can get the help. Make sense? Get some good therapy. It doesn't take 5 seconds to qualify somebody. I mean, 15 minutes and a cup of coffee, and you can qualify somebody and help them get on the path. This is the frustration for me, is that I'm 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. They ask me when I walk in the door, do you have a desire to stay sober? And I said, yeah. You know, and I mean, I had an open quart of beer in my truck. I went, and I sat down, they said, welcome. That was the extent of my qualifying for 7 years. And that's a travesty. Because I'm sitting in the meeting and I'm watching Julia, and she's not working the steps and she's not doing anything, but she's staying sober. I'm assuming she hasn't done her 4-step yet. Why should I have to do my 4-step? But Julia's not a real alcoholic. I am. And my life depends on working these steps and working these steps rapidly, getting through the work. Make sense? It's like what we talked about last night, real quick. It's like what we talked about last night. If you can come in here and take your time to work the steps, and you're comfortable, and your life is good, some of y'all are rolling your eyes in here like saying, like, what the hell's all the big deal about? It's nothing. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the Catholics that I talk to hundreds of emails and thousands of phone calls that I get at my hospital, and cats calling miserable in sobriety. That's a tragedy. I didn't get sober to be miserable. And yet we watch so many people do that because the spiritual malady was never treated. They're just not drinking one stupid long day at a time. That's the tragedy. Who else got a question? First things first. Let's find out if he even needs to be here or not. Because I don't want to spend time with somebody that doesn't. I was talking to somebody last night. I don't know if I'm an alcoholic or not. You with us? And the first thing out of her mouth, she starts telling me all this drama. But I don't know, quote, I don't know if I've hit my bottom yet. Y'all ever hear that? Understand, when those guys, after my suicide attempt, and I'm sitting in that room and they got the book open and they explain this physical allergy and this mental obsession to me, I'm going to tell you something, guys. When I understood that I had a form of mental insanity and that I couldn't make I couldn't manage the decision to stay stopped, that was my bottom. It wasn't eating out of dumpsters in Houston, Texas. It wasn't blacking out eventually. It wasn't getting arrested. It was this realization that I was going to die of this disease. And he brought me straight to the lowest I'd ever been.
There's a great story in our big book about Bill Dotson, alcoholic number 3. And Bill and Bob go pay a visit on him. And what they do, they talk to him for an hour. And what they do in that hour, they qualify for him so he can identify with the drinking, the allergic drinking, and the state of mind that precedes the first drink. And what he keeps saying is, yeah, that's me, I drink like that. There's identification, one drunk with another. Not a drunk laying in bed and maybe someone's addicted to crack cocaine or an overeater or a gambler sitting down talking to a drunk. But one drunk talking to another, and they have them. They're on common ground. And then what they do, they go on to talk about the mind to him. They talk about the body's reaction to alcohol, and they talk about the spiritual solution that they find and how to get there. And the guy is still laying in a hospital bed. So they give him the information after they get him to identify with them. They qualify him. And then they give him the solution to the body, mind, and spirit. On the third day, he leaves the hospital never to drink again. Turns his will and life over to care of God, never picks up a drink again. They didn't sit down and say, okay, Bill, let's talk about your dysfunctional family, or how you feel today, or let's talk about your issues and your triggers, and we won't get you angry by talking about God today, because I know that'll get you angry. We don't want to upset you. They nailed him in the detox bed and told him about God, that was the solution. And if he didn't want that, Bill and Bob would pick up their bag and go get another drunk. But he was a real alcoholic, Bill Dotson, who knew he was at the bitter end and was begging for a solution. And they gave it to him. So they talked about this and nothing else. And once he did that, he was able to follow some other directions. First, let's go to the back.
Yeah. I've sponsored some. Yeah, sometimes you didn't know who you were talking to, but they did. Yeah. Yeah, we still see it, and it's a huge issue in the States. Again, it's some of the stuff. I'm not a doctor, and I don't ever tell anybody to not take these medications. There's a book out there called the Antidepressant Fact Book that talks specifically about some of the dangers of this. It always drives me crazy when we get a newcomer coming into our hospital. He's been on about a six-month methamphetamine run, right? And he's coming off about 2 days, and he's coming out of his skin, and the doctor looks at him and says, are you depressed? You know, the guy's suicidal, you know, and he's just nuts. And he says, yes, and they give him an antidepressant. I mean, that is ridiculous. That is absolutely ridiculous. Because all of these medications, they all have side effects. And they all have... One will destabilize another, and that's why it was so terrible when we start multiplying and stacking these medications on top. We start to mask the symptoms that we need to talk about. The thing that finally got my attention in 1987, when I got back to the rooms, they had me look at pages 23 to 43. There's four stories in there that talk specifically about the mental insanity that is alcoholism.
Jim, the car salesman, and Fred, the businessman. And I mean, these are some great stories that talk about the insanity. They talk about specifically this mental blank spot when I've got every reason in the world not to drink. I'm pregnant, and I have lots of things going on, and I'm not going to drink, but yet I drink anyway. You follow us? And you would not do that unless this mental insanity was in place. What I try to explain to the cats is we're not letting the alcoholic off the hook here. The book says I've lost the power of choice in drink. It didn't say I've lost the power of choice. I have thousands of choices. I don't have a choice whether I'm going to drink alcohol. 18 years sober, I don't have a choice. I have choices in my life today. Am I still an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous? Do I still have a sponsor? Do I still sponsor others? I sponsor gazillions of guys, because the more I sponsor, the better I get. Those are choices that I get to make. But what you're saying, if you could get some of the literature that talks about it, I've got an article up here by Dr. McCauley that also helps explain some of the physical stuff that goes on with us. As a direct result of, there's a cat out of Kentucky, a guy named Burns Brady, that's got some great CDs out there. I can get anybody in here copies of those CDs that talk specifically about the medical stuff that they're discovering today that just verifies everything Dr. Silkworth said, 75 years ago. It's unbelievable how different physically we are. It's just such an assumption that the alcohol in me is going to do the same thing in me it's going to do in somebody that's not an alcoholic. And it's amazing what happens in our bodies. We metabolize this stuff completely different than a normal drinker. It's got nothing to do with the way I was potty trained.
I was particularly struck by this catastrophic statistic. These are the statistics I'm aware of, which are given by doctors at the Geneva Hospital right now, people I know well, and who fortunately are in favor of the AA program. Now, the statistic they show is, this was done about 4 years ago, I'm sure you know about, over 3,000 patients. I'm sure you have heard about this survey. So these 3,000 surveys, this is on year one, and only, it gives statistics over a one-year period only on these 3,000. And what they say is that they have seen those who have three solutions. One, those who try on their own to recover, having quit the clinic. What is the situation after 1 year? So solution one, only 25% remain abstinent. Let's call it abstinent, according to their terminology. Number two, those who only go to AA, don't ask me whether they go seriously, not seriously, go to AA, 50% remain abstinent after 1 year. And three, those who, you will not be surprised by that, typical clinic center selling point, those who go to AA with a psychological, what do you call that, caring, these are 62%. Something like that, of them remain abstinent proudly after only 1 year, which for us doesn't mean too much. But these are certainly statistics I have heard recently, and I really would like your comment on it compared with the catastrophic 8% figure you have mentioned before. That's all.
This is the grinders. Did you hear what Peter said? What Peter asked? I mean, I can't tell you how many people end up coming to treatment because they drink too much that are not even really alcoholic or addict. But given sufficient reason, they don't want to spend the money anymore or get in trouble anymore. They're able to just stop and walk away. We have some of these same, I've seen some of these same kind of statistics in the United States, a lot of them associated with other treatment centers. Let me run you some chip sales down. In Dallas, Texas, in 2004, we sold, at Intergroup, we sold 22,769, nearly 23,000 desire chips. You with us? In 2004. 1 month chips, 5,680 in the same year period. You'll see a little drop off there? 1 year, we sold 1,297 bronze 1 year medallions.
in Dallas, Texas. These stats are the same. We've been monitoring them since 93. That's about 5% right there. Why? We had 23,000 people come and pick up a desire chip, screw up their courage, walk into a meeting saying, I want to get well. And at the end of a year, we've only got 5% still staying sober. I mean, can y'all see where the discrepancy is here? What the problem is? We want to blame it on the newcomer. The truth is that the newcomer's not hearing how to get sober. Everybody's tiptoeing. Everybody's doing the little AA tiptoe. You know, we don't want to scare them out of here. They told me in the early 80s when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, said, Chris, don't talk about the God stuff too much. We don't want to scare away the newcomer. God, let me see if I can get this straight. You're just telling me on one out of one side of your mouth that God's going to get me sober, but you don't want me to tell the newcomer that. You'll see where the problem is? I got sober walking in the back door of an AA meeting, guys. I didn't go to treatment. I did many treatments before, but I finally got sober, understand, walking in the back door of an AA meeting. I do the statistical work at our hospital in Hunt, Texas. And of the cats that come, the guys that we're able to stay in touch with, which is the great majority of them, what we do is we're monitoring them. We got about a 50% success rate from that hospital. But if you'll correlate the figures a little deeper, all of those cats are active at Alcoholics Anonymous or Cocaine Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. The cats that just go to treatment and leave and don't get connected when they leave fall flat on their butts. They do not stay sober. And we've watched this for the 13 years that I've been at that hospital. This is the solution right here, guys. This is the solution. Absolutely. We're going to some of the stuff that we're going to talk about later this afternoon is going to go right straight down this aisle, because we're going to hit this sponsorship thing a little bit. Because a lot of you guys, that's why people don't want to do it, because they don't know if they want to do it right or not. And I got to tell you guys, there's only one way to do it, and the Big Book kind of explains it. You get to set the parameters about what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do. I am not a therapist. I love therapy. I have a list of therapists. I have a list of doctors. I flip them to whoever they need. This is the arrogance of me to think, just because I got sober 18 years ago, that I can fix any problem out there. I only know one thing. One thing. That's this stuff right here. That's the alcoholism. I know how to get you connected to God.
I sat in a meeting in South Jersey back home, and it was one of these meetings. Who has an issue they like to talk about? And they started out the meeting that way, and the meeting went off the cliff right from there. They usually do, right? And one woman shared something that was pretty horrific about her niece who had some mental disorders and committed suicide. And the whole lead up to that. And that's pretty dramatic, but I thought she should be sitting with a sponsor and a therapist to work through that, right? And so what happened to that meeting was all the AAs turned into guru therapists, totally unqualified, and were telling this woman what she should have looked for, the signs, and all this very deep seated issues that she should have noticed, and it went on and on and on, and I was crawling out of my skin. And they had no right to offer that because no one in the room was a doctor, right? And they should have lovingly told her where she needs to go discuss that. Take that story and apply it to sponsorship. I've worked with lots of guys. I sponsored guys who were gay, and they would tell me about some of those things. I don't identify with that. Right? I would point them to people in AA that maybe they can have that commonality with. I'm a victim of abuse. I can talk about that stuff. Whatever we do and don't talk about, my focus is what the 12 and 12 says, shoemaker, stick to thy last. I do one thing well, rather than many things poorly. So you're an alcoholic like me. We meet on common ground, and that's what we're going to talk about. I'll incorporate some other things during the time we talk, but I'm not going to allow you to just dump on me hour after hour. It's not healthy for the prospect, and it's certainly not healthy for me. Our sponsor is famous because he'll always talk about this. With some guys, he has them on a timer. You got 3 minutes, go. I have a gentleman, and part of my amends to this guy is to take his phone call. And he'll call me 2-3 times a week. But it gets sometimes where the person is just needy and just wants to unload for a half hour, and I will not allow that. I will not allow that. I have enough within me today, and I know it's not healthy for them. So what's going on when you're speaking to the prospects, there's usually the spirit move. You say, okay, I'm done, and we're done. I need to move on to someone else. Yeah. We're not therapists.
You know, I've never understood the controversy with this, because it was ways it was explained to me when I finally got to this fellowship. This is so open and roomy. You can make this power anything you want. The weather, that lake, I don't know. You can put any face on it you want. You don't have to be Christian. You can be Muslim. You can be Buddhist. Whatever. But you got to pick something. It's not an option. It's not. Oh, don't worry about the God stuff. You better worry about it. If you have a problem with it, let's talk about it. Let's get it. That's why they had the whole chapter called Chapter to the Agnostics. You know, my buddy DJ in there back in Texas talks about the other name for the Chapter to the Agnostics is Change Your Mind. You know? Well, I just don't believe in God. I'm never going to believe in God. Go drink. Someday, you'll crawl out of an apartment so filthy, and your spirit will be so broken that you'll reach up and say, there's got to be something else. At that point, you're teachable. We're not going to force you to believe anything, but you're going to believe in something. And for us to waste our time with anybody that is so adamant, you think you've got some power? Guys, look at the first step. I'm powerless over alcohol. Are you? It's a question. Are you powerless over alcohol or not? Well, yes. Well, then would you like some help? Well, yes. Then let's go. It's just that simple. It's like simple. You want the group as your higher power? If you want, I don't care. But there's a power. I'm going to tell you guys, this morning, I didn't have anything to do with this sunrise. That's all I need to know. Nothing to do with that sunrise. Just stop walking on eggshells around it. It's just real simple.
Is what a lot of new people, what gets confused is that when we approach step two and talk about the need for power, that the newcomer thinks they have to immediately experience God there, that they have to be full believers. And really it comes down to, are you willing to believe in group of drunks, G-O-D, good orderly direction? It says in our book, our own conception, no matter how inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach. So you come. I always hook them this way. You're having a problem with God, okay. I always ask them, are they willing? Yes or no. And they usually say, well, yeah, I guess. And then I always get them this way. Why did you come to Alcoholics Anonymous? Because I want to quit drinking. So in other words, Alcoholics Anonymous can help you stay stopped, right? So is that not a power greater than yourself? Got them. So you're willing to believe in something. And if you're having a problem with this conception of God, you did walk into Alcoholics Anonymous, so somehow that's a power greater than you. So whether you know it or not, you're in a spirit of willingness, and that's all we need to do, all we need to have to move on. When we get to step three, we just simply make a decision to get to this power, and 4 through 9, the spiritual revolution will happen, and suddenly this vague, kind of out there God of their understanding becomes something that is experienced and becomes personal to them, and that's when the person who walked in the door looks different than who's sitting in front of you now. So am I willing, yes or no? It says on page 47, do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? The book doesn't say the type of power, just a power greater than myself. Am I willing, yes or no? And that's all I need to hear from the prospect for us to go to the next step. I was driving home from Pennsylvania on business. I was coming home from a treatment center. And it still gets me. Because I will tell you, when I was in like my fifth treatment center, I would hear people talk about God, and I would do what the book said, bristle with antagonism. Don't talk about that to me. Look what it's done to me. You know, I blame God, blame God. And then there, when I hit the bitter end, I was saying, there's got to be something else out there. And things started to change for me. I was going to get to a point about this, and I lost it. Let's take another question. Yeah. In the back. Last question? Okay.
I'm a huge one on meeting formats, because we get real general about, you know, they've got to all be open discussion. And if you allow the meeting format to be
anything anybody wants, then that's what you're going to get. You know, so we get try to get kind of specific. We have some things in Texas we call foundation meetings, where all we do is cover the first step stuff, body, mind, spirit, try to qualify them. That meeting that I was in that first night, though, they just went around the room and they got very specific. Can you share with Chris, our newcomer, some how your life has changed as a result of working the steps? Not how did you get here, not all the goofy stuff. How did your life change as a result of working the steps? Which is not said is, if you haven't worked the steps, shut up. We're not interested in hearing your experience. But that's true, you've got meetings up there.
Yeah, it's pretty neat because we'll do formats where there'll be some Q&A or some first step talks on what is an alcoholic. What's the difference between alcoholic and addict? Are you an alcoholic? Are you an addict? Are you none of those? And if you take statements out of the book and turn them into questions, they'll usually leave you with your truth. One of the things we talk about is going through Bill's story, for example. Did I drink like Bill? Did I feel like Bill? Did I think like Bill? The first 9 pages is Bill's drinking. I can underline and what. Did I experience any of this? Go through doctor's opinion. Do I experience the phenomenon of craving? Did I experience the obsession of the mind? In doctor's opinion, talks about how these allergic types can never use alcohol in any form at all. Was I able to use alcohol and not experience an allergy? Maybe not alcoholic. And what I have people do also, what our groups do, is the second half of Bill's story from 9 to 16, right? We'll underline things we experience resistance to, getting back to God, where Bill starts to talk about his conception, ideas about God, and they'll underline some of that stuff. And if they're experiencing any resistance, that could be a precursor into their step 2 as to what they're going to experience about this God deal. But we try to let them know also that step contemporary AA will tell you this. Step 1 tells me I can't drink. Bad information. Step 1 tells us you are drinking. That's the power, lack of power, choice, and control. Not that you can't. You are going to drink. You're going to drink without power. And step 1 or 2 paint someone into a corner.